People are emotional beings first. People's emotions, feelings that they're not alone, that they are part of something, that they find meaning, all of that comes first before they believe in a particular issue, in a policy, in a political ideology, or even in a politician, or even in believing that voting or joining a rally is important.
What are the stories that are in people's heads about what is just, what is unjust, what can be changed and what can't be changed, and how those things that can be changed should be altered?
Hello, and welcome to the Practical Radicals podcast. I'm Stephanie Luce.
And I'm Deepak Bhargava. Today on Practical Radicals, we'll be talking about the strategy we call narrative shift, and we'll be joined by two leading experts, Christina Jimenez and Alan Jenkins.
In the past decade and a half, progressive strategists like Christina and Alan have learned a lot about the importance of narrative and about stories. Which kinds of stories have the power to change our politics, which ones don't, and how crucial stories are to saving multiracial democracy.
You're hearing sounds from Zuccotti Park, the scene of Occupy Wall Street in the fall of 2011. It was a moment that caught the world's attention. But after protesters were kicked out of parks around the country, skeptics asked, what did Occupy accomplish?
So I spent a lot of time in Zuccotti Park myself and actually ended up writing about it with my colleagues Ruth Milkman and Penny Lewis. And we concluded that while Occupy did not succeed in shutting down Wall Street, it actually made an enormous contribution to shifting the narrative in the country, to changing the common sense about how we understand the causes and culprits of the 2008 economic crash and the ongoing crisis of inequality.
A lot of people critique Occupy Wall Street, saying it didn't change anything, even if it changed the narrative. But Stephanie, in your report, you show how media mentions of inequality went way up as a result of the protest. But did that really make a difference?
Yeah, so the people that were camping out in Zuccotti Park and in other Occupy spaces around the world didn't actually have demands. So it might seem from the outside that this was a pointless protest. But by changing the narrative, they opened up space for new movements and campaigns to emerge, taking on the issues of inequality at their heart, such as the campaign to abolish student debt, the fight for 15 in a union, and the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And some of that was possible because the Occupy protesters themselves went on to help build the other campaigns, but some of it was made possible by creating the political space to talk about the issues that had been ignored for so long.
And the message that Iowa has sent to the nation, the message shared by the American people, is that we want a government that represents all of us, not just wealthy campaign contributors and the 1%.
We're thrilled to welcome Christina Jimenez on our show today. Christina's been a longtime colleague of mine in the immigrant rights movement. Christina is the co-founder of United We Dream, the largest organization of immigrant youth in the country. And she now works as a distinguished lecturer at the Colin Powell School at CUNY's City College in New York City. Christina is co-chair of Leadership for Democracy and Social Justice, which trains young leaders and emerging leaders, particularly people of color, for careers and social change. Stephanie and I had the pleasure of co-teaching the Power and Strategy class with Christina for a semester. Welcome, Christina. It's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here, Deepak and Stephanie.
When Stephanie and I started teaching the Power and Strategy course, one of the models we struggled with the most was a narrative shift. Neither of us had really worked in that model, and I confess we even had a little bit of skepticism that it really was a model. But we decided to invite you to teach a class for us and explain what's meant by narrative work, because it's something you've just had a lot of experience with in your own organizing work. So, Christina, can you talk to us about what the narrative work was that you did for United We Dream?
Yes, and you know, it was such a wonderful opportunity to be able to co-teach with both of you on power and strategy. And it really, that opportunity helped me to really start actually honing in about, you know, how to teach, how to train folks around narrative power and narrative strategy. So I'll start by sharing a bit of the origin story of the immigrant youth movement, because this gets to your question. In the early years of the movement, sharing our stories was an act of self-determination. It was an act of healing by which we would shed the fear of being undocumented, the shame of being undocumented. And it was also what helped us move from isolation and being in the shadows to connecting with other undocumented young people. And by hearing and learning about other stories, we built solidarity and we built a community. And when we took the step of, you know, taking action, so for example, stopping deportations. And, you know, I got the opportunity to meet you, Deepak, at the time where I joined the We Are Marie campaign, which aimed in the early 2000s to stop the deportation of Marie Gonzalez and her family, one of the first public cases of a young person and their family fighting deportation. And so when we took action to stop those deportations, we collectively gained a sense of agency and empowerment that we didn't have before. Now, what I've described with you quickly here is the transformation that happens when people are part of community organizing. And, you know, I wanted to start with that because our movement really came from a place and a DNA rooted in building community and the power of people coming together, what we think of it in the book and naming the book as solidarity power. But as we were building this people power and sharing our stories to build a shared identity as undocumented young people, we realized that if we did not change the views about immigrants and the stories that people believe about immigrants, and you know, that includes policymakers and the general public, we will not be able to change the policy and the politics of immigration. So the strategy for us was using the stories, not only for our internal purposes of building community and empowering young people, but to lead tactics like mass coming outs, right? Like coming out public events where young people were coming out as undocumented and unafraid and queer and unashamed, and doing that in a public way so that we can disrupt the dominant, toxic, dehumanizing narrative about immigrants. And with the intention of humanizing the immigrants that we constantly talked about. So shifting the narrative and that strategy became one that recognized, like, you know, we are dealing with very toxic, inhumane narratives of immigrants and immigration. Like, for example, immigrants are bad. Immigration is bad, right? Like, those are the narratives that dominate the discourse. And we shifted that to undocumented and unafraid. We belong. This is our home. We are here to stay. And in the process of those new narratives, what we did in our movement and what we learned that we were doing is that we created a new social identity for undocumented young people that believed in the dominant story of, I'm not worthy, I don't belong here, I'm bad, this is not my home, to one where we could really be unashamed, proud of who we are, and believe in the world where immigrants are worthy of dignity and of thriving. And this shift was one of the key strategies to be able to win DACA and the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which is, you know, huge victory in the immigrant justice movement in 2012. So I start by sharing this story because I find it that sometimes it's difficult to really understand what narrative power and narrative strategy is about. And I think that this example, like, opens the door for folks in our movements to start getting a taste of what this work is about. You know, I'll connect this now to explain a little bit more about what's the framework of narrative strategy and how we understand narrative power. And I do want to give credit where credit's due, that a lot of what I've learned about the framework of narrative strategy and how to build narrative power, I have learned from visionary organizers like Ai-Jen Poo from the National Domestic Workers United and artists and narrative strategists like Bridget Evans, who leads the Pop Culture Collaborative, and, you know, we also name in the book, because this is an emerging field in our sector, in the sector of social justice movements. So narrative power is the dimension of power that aims to shift culture. What does culture mean? Changing and shifting people's beliefs, values, worldview. And if we think about it, culture is where people are at all the time. What do I mean by this? We're consuming culture and living in culture all the time. The things that we watch, the music that we listen to, maybe the digital content that you have on your Instagram account and other social media platforms. That's the culture that we live in. So this is why it's critical for our movements to think about this dimension of power, because people are living in culture all the time, and only sometimes they enter into what they consider to be the world of politics. And then the other thing that I want to lift here about the importance of this power, of narrative power, is that people are emotional beings first. And, you know, we have heard this many times through different research. And, you know, one of our colleagues, political science professor Harry Han, has done research to understand people's participation in the civic process. Why do people participate? And what she finds is that belonging, by that I mean like people's emotions, feelings that they're not alone, that they are part of something, that they find meaning, all of that comes first before they believe in a particular issue, in a policy, in a political ideology, or even in a politician, or even in believing that voting or joining a rally is important. So this is why this source of power is so critical for our movements to understand and to build along the other strategies and the other sources of power that we name in the book, because narrative power, narrative strategy is really contending for people's emotions and sense of belonging, how they make meaning of the world, and what are the stories that they have about the world, but also about themselves and their own identities. And so when we are developing narrative strategy, narrative interventions, the way that, you know, Bridget has invited us to think about this is that we should think about this as narrative oceans that we're swimming in all the time. So these stories, these narratives are the oceans that, you know, we are swimming in, and that these stories and emotions and values are getting reinforced via different ways. Again, what we're watching on TV, the things that are being written by reporters in different media outlets. And so when we think about narrative shifts, we think about the waves that we can create to disrupt those toxic narratives, those toxic oceans that we're swimming in. And those interventions, really, if we do that at scale and we continue to do this, which is long-term work, I truly believe that we are going to not just be riding the waves in the ocean, but creating the waves that are going to change the way that we think, the way that we believe about the world and the worldview and the stories that we have about ourselves and our society.
So thanks for that. That is really helpful too for me, because I think a lot of the narrative work that I had seen seemed sloppy in a way. It seemed like people trying to take shortcuts. Like, can we just come up with the right hashtag, or can we develop a flashy meme? And while memes can be important, they're not really about making transformative change on their own. And so I think what you're saying is that wave is not just the hashtag. It's connected to real organizing, base building, listening to people, getting at people's true values and identities. So can you say a bit more about that, the connection between the narrative work and the base building or other kinds of organizing work?
That's such a critical question, Stephanie, because I definitely wouldn't want for people to get it twisted in terms of, you know, thinking that narrative power and narrative strategy is a comm strategy or hashtag. Certainly, communication strategy, talking points, and a hashtag are part of what a narrative strategy should incorporate, but it's not it. And I will actually dare to say that all of the successful examples of narrative power and narrative interventions are really rooted in people, in organized constituencies who not only share their stories, like when you think about the immigrant youth movement and undocumented young people sharing their stories of being undocumented and unafraid, but because they also get to share the vision of the world as it should be. And this is, again, you know, like connecting it back to Practical Radicals, the importance of being able to lay out that North Star and that vision that we want people to work towards and to be inspired by. So the key here is the narrative strategies are not cooked up in a lab. They're not cooked up in a very expensive communications firm. They are really developed and are rooted in people. And in fact, you know, I will dare to say that when you look at the example of the work that we have done in United We Dream and the immigrant youth movement, we did not pay consultants to come up with what the narrative should be. We did not aim to develop a communication strategy, but it was young people growing up undocumented, leaving the experience of being undocumented and the injustice of being undocumented and what that entails, that dreamed and envisioned the narrative of undocumented unafraid, the narrative of queer, undocumented, and unashamed, and or even under the Trump administration, thinking of the narrative of we are here to stay and this is our home. So I do think it's critical to understand not only that they are interdependent, but the narrative strategy ought to be rooted in people, in working class people, people that have been historically in the margins, that are not only sharing their experience and their stories, but that are also painting a picture and giving us a vision for how the world should be. And then the last thing that I will say is that narrative strategy by itself, I will dare to say, it's not the thing that would lead us to success. Narrative strategy must be accompanied by other strategies. So when we look at the repertoire of strategies in the book, I often think that, and when we look at the examples, successful examples of narrative strategy, is that they must be working together with solidarity power, right? Like, again, rooted in people and the base building. And they also must be supported by political and electoral power, as well, you know, as other strategies. But by itself, I think that we are cutting ourselves short from really experiencing and seizing the benefits and the gains of narrative power if we don't think of it as one of the strategies that needs to play in concert with the other strategies that we talk about in the book.
Christina, when I hear you talk about narrative shift in this really sophisticated way, it reminds me of one of the touchstones in our book, the British cultural theorist Stuart Hall, who really emphasized what you're saying here, that there has to be a vision of a good society, of how we should live together and be together, and that powerful stories come by being grounded in everyday people's lived experience. And that seems to me to be such a critical way of thinking about cultural work, narrative work, in a way that aligns with social movements, with organizing, and actually is in a way inseparable from them. So I'd love for you to riff a little bit for us about, what are the challenges of narrative work today? What's the cutting edge? What are practitioners like yourself really grappling with in these times?
You know, one of the challenges, I will bring it back, is to the conditions that we're in this moment. The fact that we have, you know, that technology has in many ways created a system that it's completely decentralized and just massive in terms of how people are able to access content and information and, you know, misinformation, disinformation. It just creates an arena with multiple doors that we may have not had before, right? Like before, I think when you think about some of the basics and the core elements of community organizing, we think about door knocking, we think about like house meetings. And now there's a whole bunch of like millions of different doors in which people are entering, millions of spaces that people are engaging in and finding meaning and learning about the world and making meaning of the world. So the conditions makes it more challenging for us to really think about how do we drive some of these narrative strategies and reach scale and reach people beyond, you know, the choir, beyond the people that are already part of many of the movement organizations. So this question of infrastructure and how do we build and the infrastructure that needs to be built to reach people as we have a more decentralized and vast way of people getting information, but also of building community online. So I think it's important to remember to not get overwhelmed by that. I think we are in a moment of huge opportunity, actually, for us to think about how to develop that infrastructure. And to know that in many ways, we've done it before. When you think about, you know, the LGBTQ movement and really driving the shift of love is love, or, you know, how the civil rights movement really changed the conversation and the consciousness of people. Again, those were, you know, different conditions, but well, we've done this before. So now we actually have more tools. We have technology. We have social media platforms where we can reach people to scale. And, you know, we also have AI, which, you know, for many of the terrible things that I think are very real, there is, I think, an opportunity and a question for movements for how to use AI for good and AI for us to reach more people and organize people. So I think that the infrastructure, you know, it's one of the challenges, and then I'm connected to the second challenge, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity for cutting edge and innovation, which I'm really excited about, is our organizing models. So our organizing models are truly just not meeting the conditions that we're in. That's not to say that, you know, the practice of deep base building and one-on-ones and community building, I don't mean that that doesn't work. I mean, that's important. That's work that we need to continue to build on. And we also need to contend for where the other places where people are at. They may be in gaming communities. They may be, you know, online. They may be in communities where they are digesting different content online, from fashion to food and cooking to lifestyle. So people are in different places, particularly in this moment where there's just a lot of isolation. People are finding community, and, you know, COVID really disrupted the way in which people find community. So a lot of people have now err on the side of finding community online. And I just don't believe, and this is not just my belief, but I think something that has been affirmed by my participation in a different project of strengthening organizing, where we interview hundreds of organizers, and there seems to be an agreement in our movements that our organizing models need some updating to really meet these conditions and to think about how to use technology and digital tools to build community, to reach people, and to be able to get our stories and our narratives of the world that we want people to embody and to believe in and be able to reach them through that. So I think that it's an important question. And the last piece that I think is connected to this organizing model opportunity that we can think about is that when you think about upsurge moments, and I think, you know, one of the examples, it's looking at the movement for Black Lives. Like, what an upsurge moment. What a moment where millions of people, not only in the US, but the world, were shifting consciousness about racism and, you know, acknowledging the racism exists and creating a conversation about racial justice. You know, there were millions of people that joined actions and marches and rallies. But the question is, were our movements ready to engage all of those millions of people? I will dare to say that we weren't. And so the question that we have is also, like, how do our organizing models and our organizational models are built in such a way that they will be agile for when there are upsurge moments, that we just don't ride them, but that we actually leverage them to bring people into our movements and to engage people in the long-term project of building a multiracial democracy that works for all of us. So, you know, I will say that that's the challenge, but also just like what a huge opportunity we have in this moment to rethink and to innovate around our infrastructure and our organizing models.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ways in which we could think ahead now to the kinds of crises we know are coming. There will be another climate crisis. There will be another, I hate to say, but there will be another bad election outcome. There may be another economic crisis. And we know the explanations for those, but the conservatives are often the first to jump in and give their version of the story. Like after the 2008 economic crisis, they jumped in to blame homeowners and public sector unions. And it wasn't till a couple years later that the Occupy Wall Street movement really coalesced enough to say, here's our story of what happened and who was to blame. And so that's a way in which also we could be preparing. Some of this narrative work takes place over years, but some is us being ready to step in these moments of crisis and explain our version of what happened.
We'll hear more from Christina at the end of the show, but now we'll turn to a conversation with another colleague who taught us and our students a lot about narrative shift, Alan Jenkins. Alan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on to discuss narrative shift as a strategy for social change.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So I'd like to start by exploring your own journey. You're a civil rights lawyer, and you've worked in the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division, and then you went on to be a major funder of racial justice work at the Ford Foundation, currently teach at Harvard Law School. And you went on, after you left Ford, to found a new organization, the Opportunity Agenda, which supports progressive movements working to improve their communications and narrative strategies. So I'd love to hear from you, what made you interested in narrative change and communication strategies as essential tools for social change?
Yeah, well, so, you know, as you noted, I've done a bunch of things. I started out my career primarily as a civil rights attorney and then was at the Justice Department arguing cases in the Supreme Court. And then at the Ford Foundation, I was supporting human rights movements in the U.S. across multiple issues, race and gender and gender identity and immigration and other types of human rights issues, but also in 11 overseas regions where Ford at that time had human rights programming. And what kept coming back to me over and over again in all of those different roles was that in the U.S., as social justice activists, and this is 20 years ago, we were not taking communications or cultural strategies seriously as tools for change. We understood litigation. We were engaged in supporting organizing, although not as much at that time as I would have wanted. Plenty of research, but strategic communication was almost no part of the funding strategy of the Ford Foundation at that time. And it was reflective of the field. We weren't getting a lot of demands to invest in strategic communications or cultural change. And it showed. So even as a civil rights lawyer, you know, we would win a lawsuit and then it would get swept away by a ballot initiative. Thank you, California. Or at Ford, we would support groundbreaking research on problems and solutions, and then it would gather dust on a shelf because there was no methodology for getting it out into the world. And, you know, more broadly was this question, which is, you know, in vogue to talk about. I'm sure we'll delve into it deeply now. But at the time, there was almost no discussion, which was broader narrative change, right? What are the stories that are in people's heads about what is just, what is unjust, what can be changed and what can't be changed, and how those things that can be changed should be altered. That was really no part of our U.S. strategy, although in other parts of the world, I was seeing those things play out in ways that we can talk about. So while I was at Ford, I got a master's degree in media studies because Ford was willing to mostly pay for that. And I began to incorporate it into my grant making and eventually decided that we needed to really scale up in the U.S. We needed to scale up both our capacity to communicate more effectively with a variety of organizations and our skill in doing so. And so with a number of others, Brian Smedley and Bill Lan Lee and Phoebe Eng, I co-founded the Opportunity Agenda to really work within the social change ecosystem to tell a more powerful set of stories, more connected set of stories. One of the things that we found early was that our most frequent opponents, typically from the conservative movement, but not exclusively, took communications very seriously, and they still do. So they were training their people very early in being effective communicators. They were very disciplined. They have it, they had at least one news network at that time, now multiple. And so by contrast, we were kind of rubbing two sticks together, right, trying to generate some heat. And so I stepped out from Ford to co-found the Opportunity Agenda, really because a number of us saw the need to build that capacity and strength across our social justice movements.
Alan, I feel like there's been a huge amount of progress in social justice movements on seeing the centrality of these strategies. There's still the asymmetry you talk about, I think, between the conservative movements and progressive ones, but there's much more consciousness, and you've been a big part of that. I do find that there's some confusion about terms. And so I'd love for you, as we enter into this conversation, to define narrative change and talk about how it's related to, but different than, framing, messaging, communications, kind of unpack that whole bundle for us.
So the term narrative and narrative change gets thrown around a lot, which, you know, on the one hand warms my heart, because when I first started in this field, you know, I got a lot of blank stares and, you know, why are you doing this? And aren't you a lawyer? As you note, there has been progress, but there is also a lot of confusion. And narrative change in particular gets thrown on a lot of things that are often not narrative change. So simply, you know, having communications capacity, right? Do you have staff who are dedicated and trained for communications? Are you engaging in both social media and traditional media? Do you have a plan? You know, do you know who your audiences are? Those are all crucial strategic communications questions. They're very important. And that's something that, you know, we also, you know, when I was with the Opportunity Agenda, we worked to advance. Framing became very popular about 15 years ago. George Lakoff, in particular, I think popularized it. He didn't invent the term or the field, but he made people much more aware of, for instance, metaphor, of what words you're choosing to include and what you're excluding, what values and themes are you invoking. And one of the things that he pointed out is that progressives were often utilizing or arguing within the frames created by their adversaries. And one of Lakoff's innovations was to really remind us that when you argue within your opponent's frame, you only deepen that frame. So for example, if someone says, immigrants don't pay taxes, and you respond with all the ways in which immigrants pay taxes, you are, you know, conveying information, but you're arguing within a frame which is transactional, which is the idea that rather than the idea that immigrants are a part of us as a nation and as a people, that somehow if they don't contribute as much as they, quote, take, then they don't belong, deserve to be here. And so, and there were a number of, you know, Lakoff talked about tax relief, that how conservatives rebranded tax cuts to be tax relief, relief being a affliction kind of frame. And so if we argue in favor of, or against tax relief, we're arguing within that frame. So that framing conversation, very important. Narrative is really about story. Narrative, we defined at the Opportunity Agenda, when I talk to my students about it, is the idea of a big common story rooted in shared values and shared themes that affects how people process information and how they make decisions. So, you know, I'll give you an example. As advocates on issues of racial justice and decarceration, we would often throw around the statistic, well, in many cities, one out of every three young men of color is in prison or jail or will be. And so for us as social justice advocates, that tells a story of inequality and unequal justice. But if our audiences are carrying around a story that is about, you know, black and brown criminality, then they're going to make a very different conclusion and decision about what, if anything, needs to be done. And so if we don't actually articulate our story, which is about a system that should be rooted in safety and equal justice and accountability and preventing harm, but is not, is rooted in instead in past and present discrimination and stereotypes. If we don't actually tell that story, then a lot of our audience is going to come to an opposite conclusion than the one that we're seeking. So that notion of narrative change is to change what is the dominant, often the dominant narrative, from one that is in opposition to our values and our goals to one that accommodates those values and goals. And when our narrative becomes dominant, it doesn't mean we win. It means we're arguing within our own set of values, our own story, and therefore we're shifting what's possible in terms of policy, in terms of laws, in terms of how we treat each other, from an unacceptable kind of battleground to one that is acceptable and where our goals are within reach. So that storytelling is crucial. And as you note, it's different from framing, it's different from strategic communications, but all those things are important and need to fit together.
That was very helpful. So I'd love to talk about how narratives are created. How are they built? And what are the core elements of a narrative?
So, you know, always we start with values and the values that we share with our audience. What do we believe in? Not just what do we believe as facts, but what do we believe in? Typically, narrative as storytelling has a beginning, middle, and end. It has typically heroes and villains. And it moves from a steady state to kind of the notion of trouble or disruption to a new steady state, which hopefully is better and more aligned with our values. So, people wonder why, Donald Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again," is so powerful and so beloved. That's a narrative. It's a story, right? It's the idea that there was once a mythical, white-dominated, male-dominated past in America where things worked. We're the trouble, right? People of color and social justice advocates that are trying to create a more, what we consider to be a more equitable world. And the new steady state that Trump and his people are seeking is the idea that we can return to that old ideal of, white male dominance and conservative values. So often people will receive that MAGA or Making America Great Again as just throwing together some words and ideas. And it is that, but it's also a very powerful story. And we have to be, and here I'm speaking not in a partisan way, but ideologically in terms of progressive movements, we have to be at least as astute and strategic in terms of what stories we tell, what values they are connected to, and what themes and notions. Think again of Making America Great Again, how much history that brings in. I think by contrast, another political example, we think about, Barack Obama choosing Yes, We Can as his slogan. And think about the story that's embedded there. Number one, there was the connection to Si Se Puede. So there was a connection for lots of activist communities from which the former president came, and also Spanish speakers and Latinx communities. But also it was the notion that we've been striving for a more equitable, more ideal America, more perfect union. But we've been beaten down and told we couldn't do it. And we've been disappointed by politicians. But yes, we can reach this new more equitable, more fair America. So, historians can debate whether that paid off or not in terms of the policy outcomes, but it certainly was an effective story that translated and connected with lots of people's values, both the base and the undecided. And that, I would say, is another critical element. There are very few fights we can win only by energizing our base or only by persuading the undecided. Typically, we have to do both of those. And so we need sophisticated narratives that can achieve both through varying messaging and delivery. There are exceptions. You think about the National Rifle Association. They have an all-base strategy. All they do is empower their base, for whom so-called gun rights are their only issue. That's how they vote. That's how they give money. And so despite the fact that a majority of Americans are in favor of reasonable gun safety laws, the base cares so much about it that they win every time. So there are some progressive causes that, or campaigns at least, that fall into that category, but that is not the norm. Typically, we need to do both of those things, engage the base and persuade the undecided.
That was really illuminating example. So I want to shift to how we move narrative in the world. So sometimes people talk about narrative as though it's entirely about the words we use. And of course it is that, right? The talking points are important. They're a key feature. But we also move narrative through action. The campaigns we run, the events we hold. So how do organizers and activists actually concretely advance a narrative once it's been developed?
So part of it is really, number one, really being in touch with that narrative and understanding what it is and hopefully having been a part of developing and evolving it. And then to your point, Deepak, making choices that continue, if the narrative is working, that are making choices that continue to tell that story. So for example, you know, you stage an action. Who's there? Who's at the front? Who are the spokespeople? What are the visuals? You know, what is the power dynamic that we're conveying? If, for example, we've decided that an important part of our narrative is, you know, a David and Goliath story, then are our visuals conveying that? Or are we suggesting something else? Are we noting that are we visually telling the story of going up against very well-resourced and powerful forces, but that we have the resolve and the moral high ground to prevail? There are a lot of story elements that lead up to that. And who you choose as a spokesperson, for example, is really critical. Is it always the executive director of the organization who maybe is wearing a suit and tie and, you know, speaking in a particular way? Does that tell the story in my example of David versus Goliath? So really making those choices that align and constantly testing, is this narrative working? Is it effective? Do we need to tweak it? Do we need to completely change it? Typically, you want to develop a narrative that is going to last over time. Your messaging might change in different circumstances or different audiences, but your narrative is going to be lasting. But sometimes there are seismic events that require you to change the pillars of your narrative. You know, I was the director of human rights at the Ford Foundation on September 11th of 2001. A lot of the narrative pillars for human rights were no longer going to be effective for years. It was years before we could return to some of those themes. And so we really had to step back and figure out how we were going to redeploy a more compelling narrative in that moment. You know, by contrast, when you have something like a COVID pandemic or a significant recession, that often provides, you know, opportunities for sad reasons, but it provides opportunities to improve a narrative that is about all of us being in it together, for example, or about why workers' rights are crucial to our success as a nation. So, you know, constantly listening while doubling down on what works visually, in terms of spokespeople, in terms of the actions that are taken, all of that should be of a piece.
Alan, can you give us some examples of successful right-wing narratives and successful progressive ones?
So, yeah, I mean, I mentioned gun rights, which have been extremely successful in, again, that's a narrative for the base of that movement. And because of that, they also have a very effective crisis communications model the National Rifle Association, because they know that there are going to be terrible mass shootings. There'll be calls for policies that they oppose, basic gun safety policies that they oppose. And they have a strategy for addressing that, withstanding those winds. And they know that if they can delay long enough, people will not necessarily forget, but the momentum will fade. And so, you know, that's been extremely successful. But, you know, thinking about something broader and more longstanding, you know, think about the idea that, you know, business and the corporate sector knows best how to solve problems. That's a story that we hear over and over and over again, and it gets deployed in lots of different ways. In other words, that there are tough problems, that government is inept in solving it, that business and the corporate sector can solve it, and so we should get out of their way, and particularly government should get out of their way so that they can bring us to the happy ending of everything working effectively. That's a narrative that was begun at least as early as the Powell memo. Future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell wrote a memo when he was with the Chamber of Commerce that really refocused that wing of the conservative movement on telling that story on campuses, in the news media, lots of, and in the law, in particular, lots of other places. And it's been extremely effective, and it's very hard to dismantle. A moment like this one, this is one of the reasons, in my view, why we're seeing the rise in the strength of labor, is a very important time to break that story, to show that, in fact, we have some very endemic problems with our economy and its the results of our economy that cannot and will not be solved by corporate actors and are going to have to be solved by us coming together in lots of forms, one of which is government, another of which is as organized labor. So those are two conservative examples, and I think I touched on the a progressive example, which is I think the rise of labor, both organized labor and the so-called quiet quitting and the like, is because there's a narrative that's it tells the story, both the rise of organized labor and the rise of things like so-called quiet quitting are really about, in many ways, driven by the rise of the story that our economy is broken, that our economy is about people and choices and policies, not just some wild animal that behaves on its own and can only be tamed by the corporate sector, and that we need to own those rules, right? That's a rising narrative. It's not yet the dominant one, but I think it's proven very effective so far. I think we can go back about 10 years to the rise of the movement that led to marriage equality and a significant but incomplete increase in the rights of LGBTQ Americans. One of the things that research and experience showed early in the marriage equality fight was that lots of straight Americans thought of gay and lesbian couples, who was the relevant group for marriage equality, as getting married, wanting to get married for different reasons than they did, right? That LGBTQ couples wanted to get married because of rights and benefits, but straight couples wanted to get married because of love and commitment. And that was in part because that's the way the story had been told, even by activists and advocates. That's what happens when you put lawyers in control of storytelling. And so there was a critical moment after some significant electoral losses, and the movement shifted the story. So love is love, right? To be about love and commitment. And to your point, they didn't do that only in terms of rhetorical choices. They did it in terms of what cases they chose to bring, who their clients and and plaintiffs were, who their spokespeople were, how early on in that pivot, they chose a lot of parents and grandparents of gay and lesbian couples who were either married or wanted to get married, because research indicated that that journey narrative was something people could hear. President Obama was part of that journey narrative, right? Like, I wasn't sure, but now I see that it was the right thing to do. And, you know, even though I'm pretty sure I went to law school with the president, I'm pretty sure he was on board from the start. But that narrative allowed people who had who were indecisive to say, okay, I'm moving along with the president. Over time, however, critically, the movement was able to substitute those spokespeople for queer folk themselves. And that, of course, was very important, not only for that particular victory, but for the fights ahead. So that's another example. And, you know, I'll just touch on the civil rights movement for racial justice in the 1950s and 1960s. What a powerful narrative from states' rights to human rights and human dignity. And that was very intentional. It was very strategic. And it worked for, you know, over a decade to produce some of the greatest changes we've seen in our nation's history.
Good Obama imitation there, by the way. So, Alan, you and I worked together on something that I think of as a prototype effort around narrative change in 2008. We worked together on something called the Campaign for Community Values when I was at Community Change and you had founded the Opportunity Agenda. And I recruited you. Not sure if you've forgiven me yet. There were some health consequences to how hard you had to work on this whole campaign. To help with an event, the Heartland Presidential Forum, which brought together the leading presidential candidates in January 2008 in a blizzard in Iowa with about 2,000 grassroots community leaders from all different parts of the country and different constituencies and communities. And these leaders asked the presidential candidates questions. So I'd love to hear you reflect on that effort and talk about it a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was a wonderful collaboration, although I did almost die of pneumonia, but it was worth it because I wouldn't even call it a proto attempt at narrative change. I think it was a full-on attempt at narrative change. It was a very early one in term, you know, as such, and you know, we didn't necessarily call it that, although I think we occasionally called it that. But, you know, it was very informative and also exciting for me and the team at the Opportunity Agenda. I think it was actually my former colleague, Julie Fisher Rao, who coined the phrase community values that we ultimately came up with together. And, you know, it was a model in a lot of important ways because it drew on in significant part because of the efforts and connections and trust that the then Center for Community Change had with community organizers and activists and organizations around the country and in Iowa. People participated and contributed. And you'll remember that we floated lots of different values and types of stories and themes. And it was really community that rose to the top. And I think for progressive movements, that's crucial. So conservative movements are much more able to simply hand out the talking points. And, you know, for the most part, people will pick them up and use them. And that's not the way our movements or our sector works. And I think in mostly for good reasons, right? We need to test it. We need to own it. We need to make sure it's consistent with our values. We need to make sure we're participating. And those were all things that we did together on the road to the Campaign for Community Values becoming what it was. And, you know, people arguing and people saying, you know what, this isn't tough enough. We're advocates, we're activists, that, you know, there needs to be an edge to this for some of our people and constituencies. And so we really, this is the difference between narrative and message, right? We developed out a large catalog of different types of messaging, not only for different issues, but also for different audiences, different tones. We did identify a villain, and the villain was a mindset. Right? The villain was the, you know, go it alone, you're on your own mindset. So we were not necessarily vilifying individuals because that would have been inconsistent with the community value of we're all in it together. But we were identifying, you know, who was right and who was wrong. We were inviting everyone, including those candidates, to be on the side of justice and rightness. And then we produced a set of materials and recommended messaging. We also encouraged people to riff on it. Importantly, I think, and I think this is important to all narrative change strategies, we had a kind of metaphorical umbrella of ways of talking about the issues that were diverse, but within the narrative. And we also talked about, so identified ways that things that we were going to set aside. You know, we're not going to talk about these issues in an us-them kind of format or in a competition kind of, you know, frame. There were a bunch of things that we kind of collectively agreed, some of which we were doing as a movement, that we were not going to do for purposes of this campaign. And you'll remember that some of the candidates themselves got it, and some of them did not. You know, future President Obama was spot on. He and, you know, maybe there was already significant overlap from his approach. I don't know. But I certainly saw a number of things that became part of his stump speech after that forum that had not been part of his stump speech before it. And so I think it had an important impact both on the presidential race and on the, you know, zeitgeist, the narrative that he brought to the presidency.
Such an interesting example. And I have this memory of a very, very powerful interaction. This goes to your point about kind of how we have to exemplify the values and how we organize an event and what transpires. And it wasn't actually planned, but it was a white farmer from Iowa and an undocumented parent who were kind of in dialogue with each other and in dialogue with the candidates. And the farmer was able to tell a story about how the issues he was facing were due to NAFTA and bad trade policy and so forth, and to connect it in a real way to the issue of immigration.
And we're looking at a live picture of Ivy Hall in Des Moines, Iowa, the site of this afternoon's Heartland Presidential Forum. The organizers of this event advertise it as an opportunity for real people to ask the Democratic presidential candidates questions dealing with real issues.
I have talked to family farmers from Mexico. They tell me since NAFTA, cheap corn from America flooded their markets, drove down the prices, and millions of family farmers in Mexico have been forced from the land.
It was a powerful moment of speaking in terms of shared values, kind of common identification, and really brought home to me the power of moving beyond just speaking about the issue of the day to tap into this deeper layer where we have shared humanity and the ability to connect.
I think the time has come that the United States and our neighbors, particularly our neighbor to the south, should have a better understanding and a better relationship than we've ever had. Why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways.
So that was President Ronald Reagan talking about immigration in a hopeful, optimistic voice that we almost never hear from politicians in the Republican Party today. And Alan, one thing that we're wrestling with it as progressives is the issue of immigration. And you and I have worked a lot on it over the years. The Republican Party has taken a hard right turn. Democrats are increasingly, and from my perspective, disturbingly following their lead on issues like the border and asylum. So you've worked with the movement over, you know, over decades, really. I'd be curious, what's your diagnosis of where we are? How have we fallen so far? And where do we go from here?
Yeah, it's remarkable to hear Reagan speak about immigration and in, you know, at times the idea of opening borders. And of course, he signed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which, you know, it was far from perfect, but included significant, what today would be called amnesty for undocumented folks at that time, pathway to citizenship. And as you know, we've moved far away from that narrative on the Republican side and increasingly, I fear, on the Democrat side. I think there are a bunch of things going on. I think, you know, the leadership at the top matters. And I think that, President Obama took him quite a long time to get to a narrative of solutions and the idea that immigrants are a part of us and that we need to move forward together and uphold rights. And then, of course, former President Trump doubled down to a greater extent than most people thought was even politically viable on vilifying and in a very racist way, attacking not only immigrants, but even the descendants of immigrants and the citizenship of people born in the United States. I think that shocked a lot of people. I think many of us knew that potential was there, kind of latent, but even I was surprised at how quickly and how many people jumped on that bandwagon. I think as it has been a huge setback, and I think unfortunately there's been too little focus on what should be backlash to the backlash. In other words, the notion that we had 4 years that were divisive and a significant departure from the values that we should hold as a nation, that were harmful to so many people and that helped to divide us as a nation, and that now we need to come back to those notion of the practical approaches that uphold our highest values and move us forward together. And President Biden, in my view, has not articulated any narrative regarding immigration or the border, much less a useful narrative. It's not to say that we as movements should be taking our lead from any particular politician. I think there's a huge danger in doing that. But, you know, that's what drives a lot of the national narrative, and in my view has opened the door for a potential return of a former President Trump. There's also poor policy, and policy matters. So you have a policy at the border by the Biden administration that, in my view, does not uphold human rights, is not practically oriented, does not, has no particular role for bringing us together or a pathway, roadmap to citizenship. And so, again, it's not all about what the current president says, but that's going to be a significant driver. And when militarization at the border is the solution to every problem that's articulated by both sides, it means that we as movements are often going to be overwhelmingly on the defensive. And it's very hard to formulate proactive and to deploy, especially proactive, positive, helpful narratives when you're working with communities that are under siege and highly vulnerable. However, I do think it is it presents, like some of these other tragedies that we've discussed, both a challenge and an opportunity for us to tell a new story, because I do know that people in the United States are desperate for a new story that is about solutions, that is practical, that speaks to hope and our highest values. I think we in movements and in the social justice sector are, as is frequently the case, we're going to have to drive that, because it is definitely not coming from our federal political class and for the most part, not from even the state and local governments, including in places like New York City, where you would expect to see it. So I think that one is going to be on us increasingly. And I understand why it has not been the case, but I think the stakes are too high right now.
So even beyond immigration, we are living in a period, as you said, of intense backlash on hard-won gains on racial justice, on reproductive freedoms, LGBTQ equality. These are all under massive attack, both at the level of values and public discourse, and concretely at the level of of policy and practice. So it's been a core strategy of conservative movements to generate these kind of moral panics. And I'm curious, how should progressive respond to these? And how do we operate in this era of backlash? What's our strategy?
Well, two things in particular. I mentioned shared values. That's absolutely crucial to every communications endeavor, is understanding your different audiences and figuring out the values that you share with them. And that should always be your entry point. But with an eye towards moving audiences, the ones that are not part of your base, but who are the persuadables, to a fuller embrace of all of the values that make up our different movements. And so empathy, I often tell my students this, empathy is a superpower. No one ever persuaded another person who they did not first endeavor to understand. It cannot be done. And so if you're speaking one language from a value standpoint and they're speaking another, you may share information, but you're not going to persuade. People are invulnerable to facts that don't fit with a story that they can understand and a set of values they can relate to. So they have to be shared values, not just your audience's values and not just your own, but ones that you share. And so I think that's crucial. But to be more responsive to your point, hope and solutions are the only and best tools to address fear and division and hopelessness. There's a reason why Obama's hope and change was so effective in that moment. He was better at deploying it as a candidate than he was in the White House, in my view. But those values are critical. But you have to be able to back it up, right? People are cynical based on real world experience that they've had. And so you need to be able to offer real solutions and ways forward and tell a story of hope and shared values and practical solutions. And, I think we've seen from past experience, some of the experiences we've talked about over the last few minutes, the marriage equality movement, the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, those were also, combating extreme fear on lots of fronts. And of course, neither of those movements was, completely successful, at least in a way that is guaranteed into the future, but they utilize those strategies really effectively while literally putting their bodies on the line. So we know in our movements, we have lots of people who have that level of commitment, who are already putting their lives and livelihoods on the line. I think we owe it to them to tell an effective story that lives up to that commitment and sacrifice.
It's such an important point about not just being on defense on these attacks that are coming to our communities, but leading with a positive, hopeful, solution-oriented story to be on offense. And I wonder if you have anything more to say about that, this kind of issue of being trapped. You spoke earlier about being trapped in the opponent's frames as a problem. Is that where we are? Do we need to get back on offense? What does that look like?
Well, we very much need a reset towards our own narratives and stories. And I think we have some of the foundations for doing so now that we didn't have 20 years ago. We have the Opportunity Agenda. We have America's Voice. We have Color of Change and the Narrative Initiative. We have organizations that are very much not only focused on effective narrative change and strategic communications and cultural change, but also that are committed to working collaboratively across movements and in an intersectional way. So, when you and I and our organizations were working on the Campaign for Community Values, there were very few organizations that were working in that space. There were very few resources to draw upon. There wasn't that much useful research. There was a lot of polling, but very little useful qualitative research about moving hearts, minds, and policy. And so we now have those. They're not, you know, none of them are as well-funded or resourced as we would like. That's probably true for almost every organization. But we have those organizations. We have the relationships. The Opportunity Agenda has trained, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of social justice advocates across multiple issues, as have several other organizations. Importantly, we need space to do it. It's very hard in the moment to engage in short-term and long-term narrative change strategies. It actually requires taking a break from the trenches, which is extremely difficult when you're under siege, but really creating a space to have those tough conversations, to hammer out what values do we share with our the audiences we're most trying to move. I'll give you a concrete example. In the decarceration and criminal justice reform space, where you have people within that movement on a broad spectrum, right? Some people trying to kind of tweak the system we have, some people really trying to abolish policing and prisons as we know those institutions, but with a lot of shared values, and then trying to reach audiences who are often afraid, and for whom the so-called law and order, narrative is the dominant one, which has been the dominant one for the history of our country. And so, one of some of the narrative pillars that have emerged from that effort, for example, are the idea that our systems need to keep communities safe, they need to prevent harm, and they need to uphold the values of equal justice and accountability. That's a narrative that I can walk into a room of prison abolitionists or formerly incarcerated people or reform-minded prosecutors or politicians. My specific messaging is going to be different with each of those audiences and with different audiences, but I can bring those pillars. Part of what I have to bring as well is solutions. If I'm working with somebody who's arguing, hey, our prison system's not working, we need to completely come up with a different system, you need to name that system, right? Because you're dealing with people who are afraid and many of whom have experienced crime and harm, physical and psychological harm and trauma. We need to be able to tell the story of our alternatives. And we need to paint the picture of what that will be. Sometimes when it's a solution that has never existed, that's one of the places that popular culture or cultural interventions can be really important. I often, as a comic book geek, I often give the example of Black Panther and the mythical nation of Wakanda, which is the idea of an African nation that was untouched by the slave trade and colonialism and imperialism. No such African nation has ever existed for tragic reasons in our world's history. But artists, starting with Stan Lee in 1965, I think, or 66, and then Marvel and Ryan Coogler were able to tell that story in a way that has been inspirational. And that notion of Wakanda, there's a Wakanda the Vote effort that has registered thousands of people to vote in places, states like Georgia. That was a story. It had to be connected to activism and advocacy and organizing, but it was able to tell a story of a future that has not actually existed, but to which we can aspire. So that was a long answer to your question, Deepak, but I think all of those are tools that we now have and know about that we really weren't aware of in prior eras.
Now let's talk about your current work. I'm fascinated by how you are really doing some path-breaking work to intervene in the realm of culture, which of course is the realm we all live in every day. It's everything we do, and it's where people make meaning about their lives. So I'm a huge fan of the graphic novel that you've put together with some colleagues called 1/6, which listeners can, by the way, check out at 1/6comicstore.com. I bought it as a gift for friends, and people really love it. It's just a way of getting into this really heavy stuff about authoritarianism and the attack on the Capitol in a way that I feel like people can connect to, because it's about heroes and courage and resilience, as well as about, you know, oppression and authoritarianism. So can you tell us a little bit about the project and what led you to it, what your ambitions are for it?
So I want to answer that question first with a story. So we have the comic book 1/6, which asks the question, what if the insurrection had been successful? And as you note, hope and resistance are critical to that. And honestly, I wouldn't want to read the comic book if it did not include a hopeful message and some real lessons about resisting authoritarianism and returning to a democracy that is better than the one that was lost. But the story is, I was at Baltimore Comic-Con. Now, you know me well enough to know I don't need an excuse to go to Comic-Con, but now I have the perfect excuse. And so I was at a table, my poor wife went 35 years without having to attend a Comic-Con, and now she's been to two in the last 6 months. But a guy comes up to us, he's about in his 40s, I would say, and it's Comic-Con, so he's got his Baby Yoda backpack on, and his son was with him, and his son was dressed as Darth Vader. And he saw the comic book and he said, "This is great. I want to buy this. How did you come up with this idea? Were you there?" And I said, "No, you know, but I've interviewed a bunch of people, and my co-author is Gan Golan, who's a climate justice activist. He's also, talked to a lot of people in this space." And the guy said, "Well, I was there." I said, "Really? What were you doing there?" He said, "Well, President Trump told us to be there. And so I went." And, I said, "Okay." And he took out his phone and he proceeded to show us a bunch of photos of himself at the Capitol on January 6th with the insurrection raging in the background. And he said, "I came on a bus with a bunch of people from the MAGA movement." He said, I got into this. He said, I went down the QAnon rabbit hole," was how he described how he ended up there. And, so they were watching the president speak, former President Trump speak at the Ellipse. And then Trump said, "Go on to the Capitol." So he went to the Capitol and he said people were starting to break in to the Capitol and he was about to go in with them. This is all his telling of the story. And a woman who had come on the bus with him said, "I have kids at home and you've got a kid at home. I don't think we should go in there. I think we're going to get in trouble." And he said, the kind of fever broke, the fever of wanting to, trespass into the Capitol broke, and he didn't go in. But he said that a lot of the people on the bus with him got prosecuted. He said he was looking over his shoulder for a year, expecting the FBI to break down his door. So he talked for a long time. So the point here, the reason I tell you this story is, there's no other circumstance in which I would have had a 20-minute, very civilized, heartfelt conversation with an insurrectionist, except our common love of comic books and pop culture. And that's why Gan and I chose to write a comic book, not because I predicted I would meet insurrectionists. That was still a surprise. But I know I'm a comic book geek from way back. And I know there are lots of people in that world. Some of them are very political, but many of them love democracy. But haven't been paying close attention to what's happening, didn't have time to read the 820-page House Select Committee report, compelling as it was. But they can be activated. They can be persuaded if they're on the fence and activated if they're already on board. And, it's really borne out. I've had hundreds of conversations with people who would never have engaged with this. I could have written a Law Review article and, tens of people would have read it, and it would have changed nothing. And we'll see whether the comic book changes anything. But I know that there are lots of people who are engaged on this subject and, hopefully get to see it from our perspective who would never have engaged with it. And, you know, I've learned a lot. One of our characters in the comic book series is a MAGA Republican who was at the insurrection. And we treat him with empathy. We try to understand him. He's someone who's conflicted, a lot like my friend who I met at Baltimore Comic Con. And that journey, again, that's its own narrative, right? The journey from unblinking belief in what turns out to be a set of lies and rooted in hate to hopefully a better place. So I have a long engagement with popular culture strategies at the Opportunity Agenda. We created the Creative Change Retreats, which are still going on, which bring together artists from across arts traditions who are committed to issues of equal opportunity and human rights. I've seen the power there. We saw with the fight for both marriage equality and greater LGBTQ plus equality, the role of Glee and Will and Grace and Modern Family reaching audiences who would not have otherwise engaged, who believed that they didn't know any queer folk, and I've been brought to a place of support, if not activism. So those strategies are crucial, and they're especially crucial at a time when we're highly, highly polarized, where people are choosing what news they consume based on their ideological tribe. But my people are still going into the comic book store and looking for what's new and what's provocative, and hopefully we'll bring some of them in through that vehicle.
Alan Jenkins, innovator in narrative and communications and culture change. It just was a joy to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Alan and Christina use somewhat different terms, but what they're talking about is at the core of good organizing and narrative work. Listening closely to people, finding shared values, and helping them make sense of what they are experiencing. It's about helping develop a shared analysis of the world as it is, as well as identify the obstacles that stand in the way of getting to the world as it should be.
Yeah, so too often we as organizers make assumptions about other people. We assume that they see the world through the same filters that we do. But to be successful in engaging people, we have to take the time to figure out how they see the world on their own terms and think about the stories and the storytellers that might help them shift their perspective over time. Narrative shift as a strategy also requires being methodical and systematic, not just relying on anecdotal conversations, but instead testing and evaluating the ways in which we communicate with other people.
I really like how Alan and Christina emphasized the role of culture and the idea that we need to find the places where people are getting their information and making sense of the world and go to them. Whether it's through the cooking classes, music, or comic books, there's a wide world out there and we need to be looking for ways to connect with people where we can.
So that gets us back to Stuart Hall, who over 40 years ago analyzed how conservatives were so successful at tapping into cultural currents, at understanding the fears, the preoccupations, where people were really focused in their everyday lives. This, he found, was the secret to their political success. And his injunctions really still are relevant to progressives today, where we get off track when we're failing to listen and attend to how people live in culture and where their attention is focused.
We close the show like we always do with some strategy tools. In our book, we don't offer specific tools for narrative work, but instead refer readers to other organizations that do this work so well. So we welcome back Christina Jimenez to talk about the tools she's used in her work. Christina, I know you've worked with a number of these organizations. Can you talk a bit about some of the tools you find useful for applying narrative shift work?
Yes. So I will say three organizations that I would name as a resource. One is the POP Culture Collaborative. It's a funding collaborative, but their part of their mission is really to help build the kind of infrastructure in our sector to be able to have and build narrative power and lead effective narrative interventions. And there are great resources around research and impact and case studies that you can find there. The second one that I will highlight is Race Forward, that actually has a link to the Butterfly Lab Toolkit, which is a toolkit that was developed by a cohort of artists and immigrant justice leaders that came together to really think about strategies around narrative on immigration in particular. And through this 1 year experience together, we thought that it would be helpful to actually create some tools that people can use. So when you look at that toolkit, I would say that's one of some of the most practical tools that people can use as they are developing narrative strategy. And then the last one that I will highlight for folks, it's, you know, Opportunity Agenda, certainly, as you've already named it here. Oh, actually, I have one more. The Center for Cultural Power. It's doing great work, particularly around bringing artists and organizers coming together to develop narrative and cultural strategies. I'm doing some work right now with them around bringing together artists and youth organizers in New York City, and the work, it's really phenomenal. So those will be, you know, resources that I will point people to.
So next time on Practical Radicals, we'll be talking about electoral work, and we'll be in conversation with Maurice Mitchell, Executive Director of the Working Families Party, about how we need to get smarter about the way we do it.
The power to be able to shift the overall conditions in our culture and our society, that is the unique power of social movements.
Practical Radicals is made possible with support from the Roosevelt Institute. Harry Hanbury and Peter Kakoma produced the series, and Peter Kakoma is the series editor. Our theme music was composed by Christian Perez Yates and performed by Trio Gophis, with additional music by Christian Perez Yates. If you enjoy the show, please follow and rate it on your podcast app and share it with friends. And join us next time for more practical and radical strategies to change the world.